From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Diamond Heights.
Emeryville, California.
Westwood Park.
Coming up, we'll meet a one-time undocumented immigrant who became the Golden Bears' golden ticket.
Being in the United States, I could play with the best basketball players. I had a dream to, you know, accomplish something in life that nobody really in my family has.
Meet Pac-12 Player of the Year, Jorge Gutierrez. Also, we'll meet a hero of one of the Bay Area's most unique neighborhoods, Chinatown.
And I was served by myself with my partner, two people, gang unit, for the whole city of Oakland.
And we'll wish a happy 30th birthday to the San Francisco International Asian American Film Festival.
We're using this year as a platform to cultivate and showcase the next generation of storytellers and media makers.
That's all coming up on Cross Currents. Today we're going to start in the sporting world, where the NCAA men's basketball tournament is right around the corner. But we're already into March Madness, with conference tournaments underway. The Pac-12 teams are facing off in L.A., with Stanford playing tonight and Cal Berkeley starting tomorrow night. One player in particular is drawing national attention, Jorge Gutierrez, Cal's point guard, who on Monday was named the Conference Player of the Year.
Favorite player's got to be Jorge Gutierrez. He just exemplifies, you know, hard basketball player. Makes you proud to be a Golden Bear.
He's just a hard-nosed, scrappy player.
The intensity he brings to every game. He's just the leader of the team.
Gutierrez regularly makes it into the sports pages, but his backstory is worthy of front-page headlines. KALW's Joaquin Palomino has more.
I'm in UC Berkeley's Haas Pavilion with Jorge Gutierrez. He's not big for a basketball player, 6'3", 195 pounds, but you can always spot him on the court by his shoulder-length curls, which he ties into a ponytail.
Well, a free throw, I guess, is one of the easiest shots in the game. Yeah. You know, so I have a kind of routine for myself.
He's teaching me the basics.
Try to place my hands in the right position, and I just dribble twice.
Gutierrez almost meditates on his free throw.
My right hand on the ball, and then after that, just relax and shoot.
It's pretty much the only time he relaxes on the court.
He's stubborn. He's ornery. He plays kind of with a chip on his shoulder.
That's Bears coach Mike Montgomery. He made Gutierrez his first recruit 4 years ago and says it was a good move.
He's kind of the straw that stirs the drink, if you will. Just a wonderful kid, and he's had an awful lot to do with us winning. I'll tell you that.
Gutierrez is a team leader and a fan favorite, but it's who he is off the court that brings his story to life.
I don't never regret what I did. I don't know what would have happened if I would have stayed down in Mexico.
Jorge Gutierrez was born and raised in Chihuahua, Mexico. It's a border state more infamously known for its violent cartels and abundant sweatshops. But Gutierrez says Chihuahua meant something much different to him.
Most people think that soccer, you know, is the dominant sport in Mexico, but in Chihuahua, it's actually basketball first.
He grew up with the sport.
It was my dad that got me into basketball. He took me and my two brothers to see him play all the time. So I thought, allowed me to see what the beauty of basketball.
It wasn't long before Gutierrez hit the blacktop himself. He played on a club team as an adolescent, but that didn't satisfy him. A friend of his had left Chihuahua to go play basketball in Denver, and at 16, Gutierrez decided to follow along. He illegally hopped the U.S. border to join him.
I made a decision to leave home because I wanted to play better basketball. I felt like being in the United States, I could play with the best basketball players, you know, and I had a dream to, you know, accomplish something in life that nobody really in my family has.
He connected with his friend and moved into a one-bedroom apartment with two other teenagers. Gutierrez didn't speak English. He had no family in Denver. His parents sent him some money every month, but it didn't go far.
My transition was difficult, you know. It was a totally different culture from what I was used to.
In Denver, the teenager found himself in the midst of a political frenzy around the issue of immigration, headed by Congressman Tom Tancredo.
Friends, we're losing our country. More than 15 million illegal aliens have invaded our land, placing a massive burden on our schools and hospitals, threatening our security, and turning our country into a bilingual nation. I will build a fence across the entire southern border. I will prosecute employers who hire illegals. I'll make English our official language and never, ever give amnesty to illegal aliens. I am Tom Tancredo, and I approve this message.
That was an ad from Tancredo's 2007 bid for the Republican presidential nomination. His sentiments had a profound effect on Gutierrez, who was attending Lincoln High, Denver's magnet school for Spanish speakers. Around 50% of the students there are undocumented, according to an administrator. But the school is legally prohibited from asking students where they come from. While Gutierrez played there, the team was largely Latino, and they were good. With their success, though, came scrutiny. Gutierrez says protesters would come to their games and taunt players.
It was hard, you know. I mean, it was something that nobody really wants to hear from people around you. I just feel like we tried to understand their point of view, you know, and we kept playing just because we gotta get used to those things, you know.
Despite the adversity, the Lancers went on to win the state basketball championship. Representative Tom Tancredo did not win the Republican presidential nomination. While he no longer serves in the House, his politics still resonate. Colorado lawmakers are considering a bill to provide undocumented students with in-state tuition rates for state colleges and universities. While nearly every institution for higher education supports the bill, the state has failed to implement it for several years. It's currently on the Senate calendar. Jorge Gutierrez doesn't have to worry about Colorado politics anymore. He has a student visa, and he plays in front of tens of thousands of fans every week. In February, he played his last home game. His family came up from Chihuahua to watch.
It was a great weekend for me, you know, having my whole family, senior night. It was just an unbelievable weekend that I don't have words to explain how happy I was, you know. And I'm pretty sure they don't even have the words to explain it either.
Gutierrez's story doesn't end there. He expects to graduate in May with a degree in interdisciplinary studies. Right now, he's in L.A., competing in the Pac-12 tournament as the conference player of the year. His team has a good chance to make the big dance, the NCAA tournament.
And after that, we'll see what happens. I don't know. But like anybody else, you know, I have a dream of becoming a pro. You know, no matter, doesn't really matter where, but, you know, that's a dream.
It's a hoop dream. If he doesn't make it without a student visa, his future in this country is uncertain. But Jorge Gutierrez has already accomplished one American dream by taking his shot. In Berkeley, I'm Joaquin Palomino for Cross Currents.
Do you follow the big dance? Have any March Madness bracket-filling tips you'd care to share? You can call us at 415-264-7106. Again, leave us a message at 415-264-7106, and we'll try to get your call on the air. This is Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Jorge Gutierrez has an amazing story, but the basketball tale that's captivated Americans concerns another player with a Bay Area connection. And this guy's story is Lincredible.
5-4. Win for the win!
In case you're among the uninitiated, Jeremy Lin became a sudden superstar this year for the New York Knicks after warming the bench as an undrafted free agent for a few other teams, including the Golden State Warriors. But Lin, who grew up on the Bay Area Peninsula, has always shown promise. Back in 2006, he led his Palo Alto Vikings to the state title.
Huge play here as Lin hits the bank shot with time running down. It's a three-pointer. Palo Alto holds on.
Ah, the early days of Linsanity. Well, our next story is going even further back to the early 1980s. And it has nothing to do with sports at all. We're going to go to Oakland's Chinatown, where an immigrant from Hong Kong made history by changing community police relations for the better. Reporter Sina Woodson has the story from our archives.
See, like, this place has been here forever.
I'm walking around Chinatown with Harry Hu. He's the former gang unit leader for the Oakland Police Department. He's tall and burly, and although he recently retired from the force, he still wears his gun and badge proudly on his belt. He's taking me on the foot patrol route he followed every day in the early 1980s. As he strolls down 8th Street, most people seem to recognize him. Some wave and others stop to chat.
I just hang out this place almost every day.
Now he don't walk in Chinatown anymore.
People are friendly now, but when Hu was first assigned here, they didn't speak to him so freely.
People in Chinatown were very skeptical because they never really had any, you know, personal interaction with the police.
Hu says recent immigrants in particular had misgivings.
They come from war-torn countries. They come from third world where the police was not there to protect the citizens, and often they were corrupted. So they don't trust the police.
That made it hard to solve crimes in Oakland's Chinatown, so the OPD hired Harry Hu in 1981. He was the first bilingual Asian American officer in the department. He spoke Cantonese, Mandarin, and Toisinese, but Hu says because of his size, lots of people assumed he wasn't Chinese, and they didn't realize he could understand them.
And people were just talking as I was walking down the street and say, man, now they put a Hawaiian here, you know, and not knowing that I was Chinese.
But eventually, people in Chinatown figured it out and started talking to Hu. It took about 6 months, but pretty soon, he says informants were coming to him. Some residents would even wait for Hu to come back from vacation to report urgent matters such as robberies. In return for the information, he kept residents informed about law enforcement activities. Hu's walking partner in the early 80s was Rodney G.
Just them getting that information and feedback and from Harry made them feel better. I could see that. And to feel better that we're involved, really involved.
With the help of Chinatown residents and merchants, Hu and G learned everyone's given names and nicknames and kept their pictures on file. Hu even knew many of the alleged criminals personally. In one major extortion incident, Hu says the entire case broke because of a nickname.
Because one of the suspects demanding the extortion money gave a nickname was Rice Boy. And I remember who Rice Boy was because I just stopped him like 2 weeks prior to that incident. I said, I know Rice Boy.
That kind of success led to Harry Hu's transfer to the intelligence unit in 1989. At the time, Asian organized crime was on the rise. Newspapers were constantly reporting on the growing gang phenomenon, like in these articles from the Washington Post in 1984.
Fear of the 1997 Chinese takeover of Hong Kong has sent a flood of Asian investment into Chinese-American communities, creating new opportunities for both legitimate businesses and a new breed of criminal gangs.
A loose-knit Asian mafia with criminal operations in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and more than a dozen North American cities is responsible for a fifth of the heroin imported into the United States. Attorney General William French Smith said the Chinese triad societies are part of new crime cartels emerging in the Far East and spreading to the West.
Harry Hu was working to stop those cartels. As an officer in the OPD's intelligence unit, he started working on the gang problem. And in 1991, Hu became part of Oakland's first gang unit.
And I was there by myself with my partner, two people, gang unit for the whole city of Oakland. And we were busy.
Hu says one gang in particular that had formed in Oakland, called Wahop Toe, began to pose a major threat to the Chinatown community. In 1991, the gang conducted door-to-door extortions all over the neighborhood, as well as in San Francisco. Soon, the operation extended to other parts of the United States and China. Harry Hu says that's when the FBI got involved.
And we were deputized as federal agents for the FBI, so we cross-designated. We could literally go anywhere, you know, within U.S., and we have authority as a federal agent.
Hu says, over time, the gang unit virtually eliminated organized crime in Chinatown. Officer Rodney G says the key was knowing the criminals and the neighborhood in which they operated.
They get away with stuff when they have they're anonymous. You know, you don't know who they are, but when you know them before they even commit the crime, boy, you got a big jump on them.
This was the shop that Mr. Jin used to own.
Hu says he doesn't see many young people hanging out in Chinatown anymore. He thinks residents and merchants feel safe to a certain extent, but admits crime is still an issue.
But it's not blatantly and right in front of you and causing a lot of problems for the community in Chinatown and threatening, the well-being of Chinatown.
According to Hu, some of the men who used to threaten Chinatown have now turned their lives around.
They're now family men. They have business established. Yeah, they will still see each other, out in the street and talk about the old days, and they say how stupid they were before,
Hu retired from the Oakland Police Department in 2005, but the gang unit he helped build is still in operation. These days, Hu works as an inspector in the Alameda County DA's office, and he stays in touch with the Chinatown community.
I still participate in a lot of their functions. Yeah, of course, folks are a lot older now.
Today's Chinatown is a vibrant place with markets and shoppers and crowded sidewalks. Harry Hu helped make it a safer place and broke the barrier between police and community. Now that's a goal all over the country, but in Hu's day, it was something extraordinary. In Oakland, I'm Sina Woodson for Cross Currents.
You can hear more stories from our series on Oakland's Chinatown at our website. It's klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Right around the time Harry Hu was hired by the Oakland Police Department, another story was beginning to unfold across the bay. 30 years ago, the San Francisco International Asian American Film Festival was born. And at the time, it was just a small traveling roadshow. Today, the festival spans 10 days and 12 venues all over the Bay Area. And starting tomorrow, you can catch over 100 documentaries, shorts, feature films, and new media as part of the festival lineup. KLW's Erica Mu sat down with festival director Misashi Niwanu to get a sneak peek into this year's festival.
Last year, the focus of the festival was Southeast Asian art and filmmakers. Is there a guiding theme for this year's festival?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this year is our 30-year anniversary. It's a big milestone for us. So we're using this year as a platform to showcase and to celebrate the pioneers who got us to where we're at today, and also to cultivate and showcase the next generation of storytellers and media makers.
Fantastic. And one of the opening night films is a film called Knots. Can you tell me a little bit about that film?
Sure. Our San Jose opening night film is Knots, and it's about a family of wedding planners who all have issues with love and with weddings themselves. It's a quirky romantic comedy, so it's going to be a really fun time, and we're excited to have a lot of guests in town for that event.
Great. Well, let's hear a little bit from that film. This is a clip from Knots.
The wedding planners are your sisters.
Yeah. Who is this?
This is my first kiss. My first heartbreak. This is a bad omen.
Why would you invite her here? I didn't know they dated.
That's right, because I meant nothing to you.
It was the ninth grade.
You just heard a clip from the film Knots, which is one of the films being featured at the 30th Annual San Francisco International Asian American Film Festival. And I'm here with festival director Misashi Niwanu. Now, Knots is just one of the many films being featured at the film festival, but there's a strong documentary contingency. Tell me a little bit about Hmong B-Boys.
It's a really beautiful documentary that is about the Hmong community, and it talks about how they feel their place is in America, older generations and their experiences, their hardships and their struggles, but then also newer generations who have their own issues but are
finding a space within b-boy dancing to kind of release that, I guess, stress that they have. And so it talks about the b-boy scene and how they use competitions and these teams to work together as a community.
My people have always fought to be free. We are descendants of the mighty general Chi Yu, who defied and rebelled against the Yellow Emperor Huang Di in China. My father fought in the secret war in Laos, rebelling against the Pathet Lao, disrupting the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and rescuing downed American pilots. When the Americans left, the Lao generals sent their soldiers to our village. They were supposed to kill my father, but they didn't.
This film among b-boys has been described as a counterpoint to a lot of the Hmong American narratives that exist currently. You know, what is that juxtaposition that we're going to be seeing in Hmong b-boys?
Yeah, I think that when you see Asian American stories or history told in Hollywood films, you get one-sided or you get a very one-dimensional view of it. And in Hmong b-boys, you get to hear from a lot of different community members, from family members to the actual b-boys themselves, and talking about their unique experiences. And, you know, not everyone has the same experience or history within America. So that's what we really like about Hmong b-boys, is it talks about the nuances and the diversity within experiences.
Well, let's move from a Hmong story to a Burmese American story and talk about a documentary called No Look Past. Tell me a little bit about that story.
Sure. No Look Past, directed by Melissa Johnson, is an amazing documentary about Emily Tay, who is a Burmese American basketball player. And the documentary is about her with her family struggling with Emily's future. Emily wants to be a basketball player, professional basketball player in Europe, and her parents want her to have a more traditional life, get married, start having kids. And another angle to the film is that Emily is also a queer person. So that's also kind of complicates her experiences.
Well, let's hear a little bit from No Look Past.
I feel separate from the rest of Harvard. It's hard for me to relate to a lot of people. I am the only gay person on this team.
You're more feminine than you are butch.
I think of butch as like, blech.
I'm definitely not close to being out because my mom's gonna destroy me.
That was a preview of the film No Look Past, a documentary that's being featured at the 30th Annual San Francisco International Asian American Film Festival. I'm Erica Mu, and this is Cross Currents. I'm here with festival director Masashi Niwanu. Now, in No Look Past, Emily Tay struggles to discuss her future as a basketball player with her parents. Mm-hmm. She also struggles with her sexual identity.
Right.
She's described as a poster child for the American dream. What is it like to have her story being featured, you know, as part of your festival? What does it sort of say about the festival itself?
That's a great question. I think as you see a lot of our films, from No Look Past to our opening night film, White Frog, you see this idyllic perception of a family, of a life, of what it means to be either Asian American or American. And the great thing about these films is that it talks about the complexities and what really is issues within the community. I think we're still pushing to have more representation and not just positive representation, just any representation. You know, one of my favorite things about our festival is that we have so many different representations and stories being told. Not everyone told in our documentaries or in our film or in our narratives are positive. There's some people that you're questioning their ethics or morality, but that's a good thing because then we have that dialogue and these different types of stories being told.
Misashi Niwanu is the director of the San Francisco International Asian American Film Festival. He spoke with KALW's Erica Mu. The festival kicks off tomorrow and runs until March 18th. You can tell us what movies you're looking forward to at our Facebook page. We're KALW News.
listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Martina Castro, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Anne Huang, Casey Miner, Joaquin Palomino, Rena Palta, Katie Steyer, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to City Car Share for providing an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll walk around in the gigantic shoes of a medical clown.
I feel like the world takes itself a little too seriously. So, like, all the times when we can infiltrate the normal world and help people to have a little bit of fun in some kind of way, you know, is really important, I think, and sort of magical.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents.
Dear in another life.
This is Rahm Bauer. He lives in San Francisco, but he started singing as a boy in a small-town church in southern Texas. He's playing a free show this Saturday at the Apple flagship store near Union Square at 2 p.m. To hear him and all of the local bands featured on our show, visit us at our website. It's klw.org. And that's where you can subscribe to our podcast. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.
This moment left undone, untouched here.